Today on Against the Grain, it's a claim oft repeated, the line between work and the rest of life is blurring. But according to Barbara Ellen Smith and Jamie Winders, that claim ignores the experiences of millions of people. I'm CS. The two scholars point to dramatic class discrepancies in the way people work and live, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. To say that someone is a worker isn't terribly descriptive, since the vast majority of us work, and there are a great variety of things people do. But generalizations about what workers are going through or how their lives are being affected by this or that abound. That's not surprising. Generalizations often drive analysis and advocacy, not to mention official policy. Today, we look at a claim that seems to be gaining steam, that the line between work and the rest of life is getting increasingly blurred. That, for example, our work days no longer end when we go home because of laptops and other devices. It's an interesting argument, and one that many professionals can relate to. So why have two scholars come forward to confront it? Barbara Ellen Smith and Jamie Winders, in a chapter they co-wrote for a new book called Precarious Worlds, argue that for many people, the line between work and life is in fact getting more defined in the face of economic insecurity, neoliberal attacks on public institutions, and the targeting of immigrants. Barbara Ellen Smith is professor of women's and gender studies in the sociology department at Virginia Tech, and she co-edited the volume Transforming Places, Lessons from Appalachia. Jamie Winders is associate professor of geography at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University, and she's the author of Nashville in the New Millennium, Immigrant Settlement, Urban Transformation, and Social Belonging. I spoke recently with Jamie Winders in studio and Barbara Ellen Smith by phone, and I began by asking Jamie to lay out the claim that she and Barbara Ellen take issue with.
For the last 10 or 15 years, feminist geographers and a lot of people who kind of do research related to the nature of work have tried to get their heads around how the work process or the labor process is changing, particularly for people kind of associated with knowledge production. And the classic example are academics. So things like your smartphone and having internet access at home and always being available really blur the lines between when you're at work and when you're not at work. I always describe that process to my graduate students. It's like low-intensity warfare. You're never not working. It's kind of always there. And so there's no, for many academics, there's sort of no clear line between being at work and being at home or not working. And that model we see in other kinds of industries, especially ones that are sort of facilitated by technology, where the argument is that life implodes into work, and work kind of becomes the only sphere. And in the process, we and kind of that group of workers are increasingly defined by what we do. We're interpolated as subjects based on the kinds of work that we do. It comes to define who we are.
And is it your sense that people who are presenting these kinds of arguments are generalizing the situation to all workers or most workers in the neoliberal economy?
I think that's happening to some extent. And you see it in particular in especially in the global north, in a push toward what used to be talked about in terms of a work-life balance is now often talked about in terms of policies of work-life integration. And again, the idea is that work can be done anywhere, at any time. It's not contained in a particular workplace. It's not bounded by a start and a stop time. And so instead of trying to maintain that line between work and home, the idea is that at a lot of high-skill, high-wage work sites like Google and some of the Silicon Valley places, there's a real attempt to integrate life into work.
So, Barbara Ellen, is the notion that the boundaries between work and home are blurry, is this a new notion or argument?
Feminists have long pointed to the fact that, first of all, women typically, although men in some cases as well, work at home. Right. Not only for, of course, pay, but also doing all kinds of unpaid labor to keep households going and families going, children fed and so on. And also have argued that we can make too much of the distinction between work and home in situations where, for example, women have done craft work at home in order to supplement their incomes or engaged in other kinds of productive, meaning income-producing activities at home. So there has been blurring, but what we see today is something that's much more clearly a kind of spatial blurring of what is work and what is the rest of life. We can work all the time, anywhere, always be available to labor, and that's really different.
And key to your, to both of your analysis is a distinction made not just between work and, quote, home, but between production, which I think means, in the way you're using it, waged labor, paid work, and what's called social reproduction. Could one of you define what social reproduction means? And I understand, actually, from your writings that there are a lot of meanings assigned to the phrase, but maybe what's a working definition for how we'll be talking about it this hour?
So when I think about social reproduction on a basic level, I think about all of the kind of labor and effort that goes into reproducing us as workers on a daily basis, as well as cultural beings. So it's all the kind of components of daily life that sustain us individually, that sustain us across generations, and that kind of enable us as a species to continue going. And so everything from child rearing and meal preparation to education to all of the kind of informal learning that goes along with socializing us into particular classed and racialized and gendered positions. And, you know, that's, some people sort of refer to it as almost the stuff of life, or of all of the kind of things that go into maintaining life itself.
And by reproducing workers on a daily basis, so we're not talking about, like, in that case, reproduction, making new human beings. We're talking about what, maintaining them such that they can go out and work the next day?
I think it's both. It works on an individual and it works on a generational scale. So it's, you know, if you think about the kind of classic model of the factory worker, which was the basis for a lot of the early kind of theorizations around social reproduction, it's when that factory worker leaves the factory, what are all of the tasks and things that have to happen in order for him, and it's deeply gendered, to kind of return to the factory the next day, and for his family to continue, and for there to continue to be a worker able to go to that workplace across generations. So it's the very material labor that goes into maintaining the household, of consumption practices, and it's also kind of the ideological work that keeps that system going.
So what's the relationship between social reproduction, this notion, and Marxism, feminism, the sort of the Marxist-feminist theoretical tradition? Because I guess you could say, well, you know, Marxism interested in labor and capital, workers and employers, and so what you're saying about social reproduction being part of making sure that workers are available for capitalist production and capitalist markets seems to hook in to at least the Marxist tradition pretty well there.
That's correct. Marxist feminists early on, and I'm talking about 19th century, not just the 1960s, 70s, pointed to all of the labor that was required to reproduce labor power or the capacity to work. And that included not only biological reproduction, but also the labor of taking care of workers in the household, reproducing labor intergenerationally, and taking care of disabled workers as well. But the key, of course, in terms of the Marxist interest, is in labor itself, albeit with a blind spot around all of the work that went into replenishing labor or labor power and the capacity to work, which, of course, is where the feminists came in with strong arguments about all the unpaid and invisible labor that traditionally women have done.
So we're going to get into some specific case studies that illustrate or support or reinforce an argument you're trying to make. But let me ask you to encapsulate that argument from at the beginning. Do you agree with this argument that the line between work and the rest of life, between production and what's sometimes called social reproduction, is blurring, is dissolving?
We argue that that's the case with a certain class of workers, particularly knowledge workers and those who are able to perform their work using primarily digital communication technologies that overcome the constraints of distance and space. But we also argue that there's a class specificity to that. We're talking about primarily more elite, professionally trained workers, highly educated workers, as distinct from many workers who still labor in very physically delimited spaces. They go to work, they go to a factory, they go to Starbucks to work, they go to Walmart to work. Their work is not disembodied or facilitated by digital technology in the same way that it is for knowledge workers or workers on the higher end of the spectrum of the labor force.
Is it your sense that this focus on, you know, knowledge work, intellectual work, academic work, that theorists are going there partly because, you know, it's kind of sexy, right? I mean, they're thinking about kind of the new economy, new technologies, and new ways of doing things, the flexibility of being able to do things, not in just one location anymore. Do you think that's part of why theories have tended to harp on this issue of, you know, college professors now being able to do work anywhere, and so that's how we should start thinking of labor more generally?
You know, I think this is a really good question, and I kind of suspect that one of the motivating factors in these arguments about the kind of blurring of the line is the sort of political project of trying to move away from this binary of life and work or social reproduction and production, in which production is always valorized. It's always the starting point. It's always the thing that shapes how we understand or how we think about every other aspect of our lives. So there's a political project associated with these arguments about the dissolving of that line and the implosion of that kind of initial idea of separate spheres. But it's also, it's a model that resonates with the lived realities of a lot of people who are making these arguments. And so, you know, when I remember when I first read some of these arguments, thinking, yes, that is exactly my lived reality, where work seeps into life and there's this constant negotiation of when I'm watching a basketball game on television and I'm checking my email and I'm responding to a student, am I at work? Am I at home? Is this production? Is this social reproduction? But then both Barbara and I were doing on-the-ground ethnographic work in other communities and just looking at very different labor processes and very different lived realities, that the kind of thinking about what kinds of politics can come out of the line between production and social reproduction if you are working in a chicken factory or if you're a coal miner or if you clean hotel rooms. It's radically different from this kind of argument about we're all life's workers.
That's Jamie Winders. She teaches geography at Syracuse University. Barbara Ellen Smith also joins me. She's a professor of sociology at Virginia Tech. And these two scholars collaborated on an article. It's called Whose Lives, Which Work? Class Discrepancies in Life's Work. In a new volume, it's called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. We have a link to that book and to the faculty pages of my two guests on our website, againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So let's get into the first of the case studies that you present in this paper about kind of challenging this argument that, hey, work and the rest of life is, you know, they're kind of becoming one. And that is what's happened to work in the South and what was called the New South. And I want to start with you, Barbara Ellen. So for some historical context, what happened in the American South after the Civil War in terms of political and economic elites attempting to expand industrial production in the South.
It was a very determined, orchestrated effort to create the so-called New South based on light, low-wage manufacturing. We're talking about a textile industry, especially furniture, and some agricultural processing industries, but particularly textiles. That was really the premier industry of the New South. And the period of time here is the late 19th century and early 20th century. The workers who were drawn into this process tended to be rural, coming off of failing farms, often people who did not own property. There is a long history of poor white Southerners who were part of course, the history of the South. And it was that labor force that was mobilized into the often company towns of the textile industry and other industries at that time.
And so company towns were established by employers to house their workers?
Yes, to house their workers, to educate children. Company towns were established by companies like Fieldcrest Cannon or its predecessors to not only house workers, but really to create the entire infrastructure, the entire social infrastructure necessary, churches, schools, and so forth. So they were those activities were very densely concentrated around the mill.
And how long did this pattern and these spatial patterns of labor in the South, how long did they last, and what happened to change things in any significant way?
By the 1980s or so, we began to see the deindustrialization of the rural South insofar as the primary attraction of the South was low-wage, non-union labor. Companies increasingly, of course, found that labor far cheaper in other locations outside of the United States. So that was part of the trend, just the relocation, the offshoring of this production. But we also saw automation such that, again, the consequence was unemployment for textile workers. But we do still have some textile production in the South, as well as furniture, and actually an increase in certain other lower-wage industries like poultry processing.
And in this article, in this book, Precarious Worlds, you cite the example of layoffs and work reductions at a company in North Carolina in the 1980s, and what happened to the lives of people who now no longer worked together in one place at the mills. Talk about that.
What we find is that many companies have, to the extent that they've remained in the South, they have relocated to more urban and proximate suburban areas. And so people who used to work in a textile mill, for example, that was right down the street, now commute on the interstate an hour to work in a mill or in Walmart or in another facility, and are not necessarily by any means commuting in the same direction as their neighbors or their spouses. So people are much more disaggregated, even if they still live in the same community. Their work lives spread in all kinds of directions. So spatially, it's a much more sprawling kind of geography of labor. But in addition to that, of course, the local school, the local church, the many other facilities of the company town, and I don't want to romanticize it because this was also a repressive and paternalistic environment, but spatially with phenomena like school consolidation and with the irregular shifts and often very long shifts that workers are working, the activities both of work itself and then also on the home front of social reproduction become much more fraught in terms of the time available and the predictability of those work efforts.
Can you talk a little bit more about just this focus on geography, which, you know, because a lot of people might not think about the material consequences on people of changing employment patterns. They might not include kind of geographical consequences of, as you said, spending more time on the highway or going in different directions. What you are implying is these phenomena, these criteria really matter to people's lives. It affects what? The way not just that they live, but the way maybe they think?
Absolutely. It certainly affects how they are able to relate to one another and how they are able to maintain themselves even as a family. If, for example, you are working an unpredictable schedule at Walmart, and in many retail industries and in places like Starbucks, in restaurants and food services, to some extent in hotels, the work schedule is quite flexible, but not determined by the employee. It's very common for a worker not to know what kind of schedule he or she will be working from one week to the next. If you are a parent with children and need to maintain some, hopefully, regularity in terms of your presence in your household, that can be extremely difficult, if not impossible, with those kinds of work schedules. And when you combine that with the fact that people are driving in different directions to get to work and thus having much less time available to spend at home, then you can see why there are tensions between the demands of work, particularly when they're unpredictable and irregular, and the needs of social reproduction, of children, for example, of child care, of helping kids with homework, of getting meals on the table, of doing your grocery shopping, and all of the daily activities of life.
And just to jump in, I think this is a key difference between kind of that model that we started with of the two spheres of your life kind of imploding, and what Barbara is talking about, because under the model where work and life are becoming one, you as the worker, you manage that flexibility. I can check my email anywhere. I can respond to students anywhere. I can download papers to review. I can work in my hotel room. I can do that. If you're working in Walmart, you're working at Starbucks, you're working as a hotel room cleaner, and you have a constantly changing schedule, that is a flexibility forced upon you. You don't have any ability to manage it. If that flexibility is also combined with longer trips to work and your kids have to go a greater distance on the bus to school, which means PTA meetings take longer for you to get there. Maybe the local grocery stores have closed down, so you have to go to the next town to buy food, to get clothes for yourself and your children. You're doing all of those kinds of stretched geographies at the same time that you can't predict your work schedule. And so that flexibility looks radically different at different ends of the class spectrum.
How integral to kind of the new neoliberal economy and the neoliberal way of doing things is just-in-time production and sort of on-demand labor and, you know, the labor that needs to be available in a different way, perhaps, than it used to be available?
I think it's central to the neoliberal economy in the sense that the presumption is that the subject, the worker, exists only to work. There is no consideration given to the fact that this person also needs to maintain herself, have a life, as we say, outside of work. There's no consideration given to that at all. And so the presumption is that you are there just to facilitate your own survival. And one of the things that I think is important is that we've talked about the new technologies, digital communication technologies and so forth, and the ways that knowledge workers use those to enable themselves to work anywhere, anytime, everywhere, all the time. Those technologies are also at stake, but in a very different way, for workers at the bottom end of the class spectrum, in the sense that they are being used to communicate with the worker to tell her, you need to get to work right now. We've got, you know, a press. The market is demanding your presence, in effect. And in some contexts, for example, I've done some research on the distribution sector in Memphis, where there are sprawling warehouses because Memphis is the hub for FedEx, the global hub for FedEx, and the Memphis International Airport handles more metric tons of cargo than any other airport in the world. As a result of that transportation infrastructure, there are all kinds of warehouses that sprawl along the Tennessee-Mississippi border in which workers are mobilized to work at the last minute when a certain product becomes in high demand. And so the physical labor is still necessary. The worker is called to that work on a cell phone or whatever device, but the employer also is aware of the market demand, and this is also, of course, part of the neoliberal economy, aware of market demand because those employers are plugged into their global supply chains, and they know that this product is needed right now, and so we need the labor right now in order to fulfill that market demand.
Barbara Ellen Smith and Jamie Winders join me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara teaches women's and gender studies at Virginia Tech, and Jamie teaches geography at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. And again, their essay, their very interesting essay about work, about the rest of life, and about class discrepancies in the way people go about their work and the way their lives maybe ought to be analyzed is part of a new volume. It's called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. It's edited by Katie Meehan and Kendra Strauss, published by the University of Georgia Press. We'll take a short break and speak more with Barbara Ellen and Jamie. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Jamie Winders is Associate Professor of Geography at Syracuse University. She's also the author of Nashville in the New Millennium, Immigrant Settlement, Urban Transformation, and Social Belonging. Barbara Ellen Smith is Professor of Women's and Gender Studies in the Department of Sociology at Virginia Tech. She's author of Digging Our Own Graves, Coal Miners and the Struggle Over Black Lung Disease. And we are talking about an article they collaborated on in the new volume, Precarious Worlds. I know both of you have been looking at and studying the lived reality of Latino immigration, Latino immigrants in the U.S. South. Jamie, you write that beginning in the 1990s, Latino immigrants moved to and settled in large numbers in the South. What drew them there?
I think there were a range of factors. There were obviously, at that time, particular push factors coming out of various parts of Latin America. You had kind of cooling economies in Texas and California. You also had kind of growing anti-immigrant sentiment, particularly in parts of California in the late 90s. You also had a group of about 4.5 million Mexican immigrants in particular whose status was regularized through the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, who now had a new form of spatial mobility, who found it easier to move across the country to go where jobs were more available rather than staying in large cities in Southern California and in Texas where there were kind of large ethnic economies. At the same time, especially in southern cities, local labor markets were booming. There was a really strong desire for kind of low-wage labor in the growing service economies that southern cities were seeing. In the rural South, we also were seeing a reconfiguration of the geography of meat processing and the movement, the kind of consolidation of meat processing into a handful of corporations and the expansion of the number of processing plants and chicken farms. And so in both the rural South and the urban South, you had this need for low-wage labor. We also saw a lot of suburban construction around larger southern cities. And so you had some international factors. You had some political factors in terms of the regularization of immigrant status. You also had economic pull factors. And, you know, in a lot of the work I've done with Latino immigrants in the South about why they came to places like Nashville, Tennessee, or why they moved to Atlanta, it was also a desire for a, quote, safer, more laid back, more relaxed place to raise children, at least initially. And there's been some interesting research by folks like Steve Striffler and Helen Morrow in immigrant settlement in the rural South that has shown that it was easier for Latino immigrants who settled in rural parts of the American South to kind of approximate a middle-class lifestyle in a way that they simply couldn't in Southern California, where the cost of living are so high.
And yet, is it fair to say that many of these jobs made available to these immigrants were low-wage, such that, you know, even with maybe a lower cost of living, it was still very difficult to get by?
I think so. And that became particularly true when the Great Recession hit. I mean, we know that across the nation, Hispanics or Latinos were the hardest hit in the recession. Some of the industries that were hardest hit in the Great Recession, like construction, were also strongly associated with immigrant labor. And then you add on to that around the same time, sort of beginning in 2006, across the South, you see growing anti-immigrant sentiment. So not only is life more difficult economically, life becomes all but unbearable socially and politically in a lot of these communities, with state and local ordinances really targeting immigrant lives.
So give us some examples of anti-immigration legislation on the federal and the state levels that really made it hard for immigrants to survive, to exist, and I guess bringing in the geography here, maybe even to leave their homes.
One of the things that we started to see kind of in late 2005, but it really picked up in 2006 in the South, is a kind of a sea change in the political climate for immigration. So when I started studying immigrant settlement in the U.S. South in the early 2000s, there was a real sense that maybe we were seeing a different dynamic. People were talking about a new form of Southern hospitality, of immigrant workers being welcomed to these communities. That sentiment changed very quickly in kind of 2006. And one of the things that it correlated with was the sort of shift from seeing immigrants in southern cities and small towns as people here to work long hours for low wages and then be invisible, to immigrants as my next door neighbor, as residents. It's when that first cohort of immigrant children, the second generation, gets into kindergarten. And this is really how Barbara and I started thinking about these sites of social reproduction, which became so central to this changing kind of political climate. They also, these sites of social reproduction became the spaces and the institutions that were often targeted in these state level and local ordinances, kind of anti-immigrant legislation, of starting to track legal status of children and their parents in public schools, of making it illegal to rent a house to someone who is undocumented. In places like Alabama, the push to make it illegal for the state to enter into a contract with someone who is undocumented, which means you can't get your water hooked up to your house or your trailer, of going after driver's licenses. So some southern states, early on, if you were undocumented, you could get a driving certificate, eliminating that. There was talk of in the mid-2000s in places like Georgia of trying to tax remittances as kind of leaked revenue of money that is going somewhere else that should come back to the states. A lot of southern communities, cities, and also counties signed 287G agreements. That program is no longer in practice, but it basically allowed local police officers to act as federal immigration agents. So it conflated local policing with sort of the federal border policing, which created all sorts of fear across immigrant communities. And so one of the things we really saw in the late 2000s is the ability to have a public life as an immigrant, especially an undocumented immigrant, just disappeared. So public spaces were no longer used. And so kind of life really pulled in at the same time that job opportunities were drying up. And so the ability to go to work became incredibly precarious. The ability to take children to school became incredibly precarious. You know, there are lots of stories of immigrants taking back roads, trying to avoid being seen. You know, and so in that context, just the ability to either live or to work becomes dangerous.
And added to that, there were some very highly publicized raids by federal immigration authorities on workplaces and other places, right?
There were. They certainly weren't only in the American South, but I think the largest raid was in North Carolina. You know, one of the things that happened is immigrant settlement in the American South really became visible as a public issue post 9/11. And so it brought concerns about the border and concerns about national security into these just beginning conversations about what it means to have a large foreign-born population in places like rural Alabama or rural Georgia or rural Mississippi. And so one of the things that Barbara and I saw in a lot of our work is the conflation of my neighborhood is changing and this is a threat to my nation. So again, the sites of social reproduction became so central to the ways that this anti-immigrant sentiment unfolded.
And you've begun to answer this, but what do you conclude from what you've just said and what you've observed in the U.S. South about the degree to which, again, we get back to this argument that the distinction between work and home, between work and the rest of life is getting blurry, it's getting fluid. What do you conclude at least about these kinds of workers? What do you conclude about the validity of that argument?
The line seems to be not blurring, but if anything, hardening. The only context in which it's blurring is when one has no paid work at all. And we do find that, of course, in many areas. But the idea that one can work and take care of the rest of life simultaneously, multitasking at home, anywhere, everywhere, all the time, is simply not the case.
It's hardening, and it also is increasingly difficult to maneuver. And I think that's a key distinction. So when I go back to my hotel room, it will be very easy for me to slip between work and play or work and life. I can move across that at will. What we see across the U.S. South in these different kind of working class communities is it's not only sharpening and hardening, it's just increasingly difficult to negotiate.
That's the voice of Jamie Winders. She's an associate professor of geography at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Also joining us by phone is Barbara Ellen Smith. She's professor of women's and gender studies in the Department of Sociology at Virginia Tech. And again, these two women, these two scholars have co-authored an article. It's called Whose Lives, Which Work? Class Discrepancies, with the emphasis on class, in life's work, and it's part of a new volume called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And I want to go to the kind of the third case study that the two of you present in this new volume, Precarious Worlds, and that is the coal fields of rural Appalachia, which includes southern West Virginia, which, according to your paper, has eight major coal-producing counties. And Barbara Ellen, you were talking earlier about company towns in the, quote, New South. They were company towns also in Appalachia, right?
That's correct, but one of the huge differences among many between those in the so-called coal fields of places like southern West Virginia and the company textile towns in places like North Carolina is that in West Virginia and other parts of the central Appalachian coal fields, the labor movement was extremely strong. The area was solidly unionized during the 1930s, so that you had not so much this paternalistic kind of company town situation where workers were very much at the mercy of employers and surveilled and so forth, but that workers had their own class, working class space and leverage vis-a-vis the coal industry via the United Mine Workers of America.
And Jamie was just talking about the closing down of public spaces under threat and under attack in many areas where in the U.S. South where there are Latino immigrants and Latino immigrant communities. In the coal fields of rural Appalachia, what's happened to public space in the neoliberal era?
We're seeing a dramatic shrinking of public space in the coal fields of central Appalachia, and that's happening through kind of shrinking of state support for various activities of daily life, including public schools. So school consolidation has proceeded apace, meaning that communities that once had an elementary school, a middle school, and perhaps a high school in the adjacent community no longer have any of those schools. Students have to ride a bus sometimes for an hour or more each way in order to get to the school. It's so distant, of course, that parents have difficulty getting there for any kind of after-school meetings with teachers or for kids to engage in after-school activities. Post offices have closed down. About half of the post offices in southern West Virginia have closed in the eight counties that I was investigating. Then deunionization, which has been a rapid and determined and violent process spearheaded by A.T. Massey in the 1980s, has, of course, erased the public space of the union hall and the kind of brotherhood, as it indeed was, despite the presence of some union women miners, but the brotherhood of coal miners has really diminished in this context as well. And then finally, with environmental deregulation, we have seen the growth of mountaintop removal, so that literally the physical landscape is disappearing. Associated with that mining practice, which involves blowing the tops off of mountains and just allowing all of the rubble, trees, vegetation to fall down the side of the mountain and fill up streams, there's a great deal of destruction of watersheds and all kinds of forms of life. The Appalachians are some of the richest, or have been historically, mountains in terms of biodiversity, and that's really disappearing.
I think what Barbara just laid out really helps illustrate again kind of that difference. If the metaphor of understanding kind of the knowledge worker is the blurring of these spheres, what we're seeing in these communities that we're looking at is, as we've already talked about, this stretching of the kind of labor and life geographies, and then, as she just described, really the scouring of the landscape of social reproduction. And some scholars put the environment as a component of social reproduction. And I think in the context of Appalachia, you can literally see how that landscape of sites of community, of sites of public engagement and public space are being scoured kind of in the same ways that the actual physical landscape of these mountains are being scoured out.
And just for listeners who recently joined us, what do you mean again by social reproduction?
So when we think of social reproduction, we're thinking of all of the kind of work and effort that goes into maintaining us not only as workers, but also as cultural beings on a daily basis, but also from generation to generation, so also the literal reproduction of the next generation of workers. It's basically the reproduction of the social, all the things that kind of keep us going as a species.
In this article, you also look at what are often called family-friendly employment policies, like flex time and telecommuting. So what do you think of such policies and the extent to which they can address labor concerns in light of what you've been telling me this hour?
Those policies are terrific if you're a knowledge worker and you're stressed about the amount of work that you are carrying home with you, and you need to be able to create more of a distinction between your home life and your work life, and you need your employer to recognize that you, in fact, have children who need your attention and that you're not available to work 16-hour days and so on. That kind of policy is very desirable, important, and necessary. But for the woman who is working at Walmart and doesn't even know her schedule from week to week, the idea that Walmart is going to engage in family-friendly employment policies is really kind of ludicrous. The greater need there is more hours, more predictable hours, and a higher wage with fringe benefits.
Also, I have a very vivid memory when we were working on, when we were sort of beginning to put these ideas together, of reading about these work-life policies and then reading reports coming out in 2009 and 2010 about the percentage of immigrant workers in the South who simply didn't get paid. So where you have wage theft and, you know, policies for work-life balance would be great there. But what would be really great would be policies that could make sure that they actually got their wages in the first place.
You've also written that kind of the dynamics of precarity and of this mandate to be willing to be available constantly and to go anywhere for work is especially pronounced among Latino construction workers. Can you talk about that sector?
Sure. So in a lot of southern cities, and this is a trend that holds probably across most American cities, a lot of workers in the construction industry tend to be younger Latino men who, especially maybe in the early years of being in the U.S., have families that live elsewhere, maybe live in Mexico, Guatemala, wherever. They're often here by themselves. They're living in apartment complexes where their roommates are all construction workers. And in that moment in the life course, the ability to be that flexible worker who maximizes hours, who works as much as he, it's almost always a he, can, that seems to work. Where we start to see the rub between those demands of being this uber flexible, constantly available worker is when life intervenes. It's when you fall in love and maybe you have a child and maybe you want to have time for family on the side, but you're also being paid wages that don't enable you to sustain that family. So maybe your partner also has to work and she's also working in low-wage labor, and so you both have these different sets of demands. And it's in that moment where you have sort of the place-based demands of life and social reproduction that bump up against these demands for hyper-flexibility from immigrant labor that you start to see some of these conflicts.
And Jamie, you referred earlier to all the anti-immigrant legislation and rhetoric, and I just wonder, now, with some of the discourse around immigrants, what you think the state and trajectory of that rhetoric is, and whether rhetorical changes or maybe even different legislative approaches might ease some of the burdens on Latino immigrant workers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I have to say, kind of going into this round of presidential debates and all of those sorts of things, I didn't really anticipate early on that immigration was going to be a significant issue. We're in the last couple of years, there are more Central Americans coming into the U.S. than Mexicans coming into the U.S. The border crossings are at incredibly low levels. And so, you know, if you think about what was the kind of empirical reality of immigration in, say, 2007, when we saw that last round of sort of intense anti-immigrant sentiment, it was a very different reality. But that the fact that we're looking at a kind of totally different context of immigration hasn't changed the fact that people like Donald Trump has managed to make immigration one of the central issues. But it's interesting because the kind of public discourse around it is much more about criminality now than it was. And so if we look back at what kind of anti-immigrant sentiment, how it was being mobilized, what were the sites that were being discussed, what kinds of actions, it was very much about these sites of daily life, about how my school is changing, my neighborhood is changing. And that wasn't only in the South, it was in places like Hazleton, Pennsylvania. It was very much around these sites of daily life. What we're seeing now is a much more kind of vitriolic, just sweeping stereotypes that don't necessarily link down to any particular places. It's just this rhetoric of hate that isn't grounded in the same way.
So what's your sense of how the insights you've both shared with me this hour and the insights you share in this book, Precarious Worlds, how can they help in terms of devising strategies to help working class people and households in a way that a notion, a theory of, hey, work and home and the division between it is kind of blurring, can't.
I think what our work points to is the need for social movements and social policies that address both the labor issues, and of course these are already happening, the fight for 15, for example, living wage efforts, the fight for paid sick days. You know, professional knowledge workers take for granted that they can take time off if they get really sick. That is not the case for many of the kinds of working class people that we talk about in this chapter. And so on the one hand, there's a need for all kinds of improvements on the labor side, but there's also a need to shore up the side in which people are trying to take care of their children, they're trying to have some kind of family life, and the demands of employers, which are so unpredictable and inflexible in terms of the requirement that you must work overtime, you must be there at a certain time and so on, or you will not have a job, that the needs for people to be supported in their social reproductive activities as well, that is to say, in terms of public education, in terms of the infrastructure of social life, for people who cannot resort to private solutions to social, collective social needs.
I think it also, you know, in the last couple of years, we've seen the move from let's talk about work-life balance to let's talk about work-life integration policies. And for some workers, in some places, with some kinds of work, that can be a very progressive move, but we also have to acknowledge the right to maintain work from life, that under some conditions, what we need to fight for, as Barbara has been talking about, is a distinction. It's not a blurring. It's not about we need policies that can integrate life into work. We need policies that allow workers to have a life. And those policies need to go all the way up to a wider investment in the social, you know, when you hire a worker, you're not just hiring a worker stripped of social. You're hiring a person who comes with connections to other people and who comes with a life, and that those other parts of our being have to be cared for. And it can't be cared for only by the family.
That's Jamie Winders, Associate Professor of Geography at the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. You might want to check out her book, Nashville in the New Millennium. Barbara Ellen Smith joined us by phone from Virginia Tech, where she is a professor of women's and gender studies in the sociology department, and she is author of Digging Our Own Graves, Coal Miners and the Struggle Over Black Lung Disease. And they co-authored an article, although they've collaborated on a number of things over the years, but the article we addressed was called Whose Lives, Which Work? Class Discrepancies in Life's Work, and it's to be found in a volume called Precarious Worlds, Contested Geographies of Social Reproduction. Barbara Allen, Jamie, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It was our pleasure.
Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.